This audio file is a production of Chiasmos, the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source. For related audio and video, or for more information about the project, please visit chiasmos.uchicago.edu or internationalstudies.uchicago.edu.
It's my great pleasure to introduce this, the first of our Latin American briefings talks for the 2007-2008 year. And it's an especially great pleasure to introduce Ricardo Páez de Barros, Tinker Visiting Professor in the Harris School for Public Policy. Mr. Páez de Barros is a senior researcher at the IPEA in Brazil, the Institute of Applied Economic Research, an important semi-official economic research institute. He is also an alumnus of the University of Chicago, where he took a PhD in economics, and the author of numerous books and articles on labor markets, on public policy, on measurement of economic equality, and on anti-poverty policies, each of these on which he's going to touch tonight. He's also not only a Tinker professor now, but a former Tinker visiting professor at the University of Chicago. About 10 years ago, Ricardo was a visitor here, and when I arrived 5 years later, the memory of that visit was so strong that students from all sorts of disciplines on all sorts of occasions would tell me things about Brazil, prefacing them by saying, well, you know, Ricardo Páez de Barros says. So the echoes of your previous legacy were just beginning to die down as that generation of students graduated, and it's a great pleasure to have you here at the university again. Now, it's also a pleasure to have Mr. Páez de Barros opening our 2008-2009 Latin American Briefing Series, which, as you know, brings together academic specialists, policymakers, political leaders to explore current affairs in Latin America. If you'd like more information on the series, including a calendar of our upcoming events and an archive of audio and video from past events in the series, I encourage you to visit our website, the Center for Latin American Studies website. We've begun streaming video and podcasts of these talks. I also want to give a special thanks not only to the sponsor of Mr. Páez de Barros' visit, the Tinker Foundation, but also to the members of the Center for Latin American Studies New Corporate Partners Program. The Motorola Foundation, New City Bank, and McDonald's Latin America have all provided general support for this and other Latin American briefings. Once again, it's an immense pleasure to introduce Ricardo Páez de Barros, and I should say a great pleasure to have with us here in the audience the new consul of Brazil in Chicago, Ambassador Jean Almino, and among other people, my colleague Manuela Carneiro da Cunha, who's been a collaborator with Ricardo on some of the projects that we'll be discussing tonight. So I'm expecting a lively discussion, and I'll turn it over to Ricardo.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. And as I was mentioned, I was here 10 years ago, and I did a similar public lecture 10 years ago, and was not surprising, it was about inequality in Brazil. But actually, the focus of that talk, it could not possibly be more distinct than from the focus today. 10 years ago, I was trying to explain people and the students here why inequality in Brazil was so large, and why it was so stable, and why social policy in Brazil was so ineffective to reduce inequality. And the presentation today has a completely different focus, because I'm going to talk about why inequality in Brazil is kind of being declining extremely fast, and what social policy has to do with that, and more importantly, maybe, what can be done for this process of continuous decline in inequality to be sustainable. Well, this is a joint work with many people. One of them is Gabriel, that's here, now a
a student in the economics department. So let me just talk about the magnitude of this decline. And this is the graph that gives you the what we know about the decline of inequality in Brazil. And I'd like to spend a few minutes in this graph. Well, this graph tells us what happens to the Gini coefficient in Brazil over this period. Well, the Gini coefficient is the income distance between people, the average income distance between two Brazilians. So if the Gini, as a measure, as a multiple of the average income of the country, so if it's, the average income of Brazil is like $600 per capita per month. So if the Gini coefficient is 0.6, that means that the distance, the income distance between two Brazilians is $360. A decline of the Gini coefficient from 0.6 to 0.56 means the average distance between two Brazilians went down from 360 and 336. And then we say, well, is this anything significant? I mean, the Gini coefficient is going down by 1.2% per year. Should we be celebrating this? I mean, this is of any importance? I think if we're not familiar to deal with Gini coefficients, and I tell you that Gini coefficient is going down by 1% every year, you may have all the reasons to feel that this may not be a lot. But let me try to show you that this is a tremendous decline in inequality. But before, let me just show you that this is not just a Brazilian phenomenon. Actually, this is going on all over Latin America. There's a very important report from the World Bank that was produced in the beginning of the 2004 and was actually considering the 1990s. And they were claiming that inequality continues to be stable in Latin America. But if you look at the data from 2000 to 2005, that's what you're going to see. And this is the numbers for 2000, and these are the numbers for 2005. And you can see that in almost every country, inequality is going down. And actually, inequality is going down faster in the countries, in the high inequality countries like Brazil, Mexico, and Guatemala. But it's not going down very much in low inequality Latin American countries like Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Uruguay. So actually, we are having a kind of a convergence of inequality where the very high inequality countries are going down. So that what I'm going to present today, I have presented this in Mexico when they claim that very similar explanations for the decline in inequality is valid for Mexico and probably for other countries in the region like Panama. Okay, so how can I try to convince you that this decline of 1% in Gini coefficient is something really large? Well, we know that any decline in inequality at the end of the day means that the growth, the growth of per capita income of the poor is going to be faster than the growth of the per capita income of the rich. That's what inequality reduction is all about. It's a reduction of the gap between the poor and the rich. So if inequality goes down, then the growth rate for the poor must be higher than the growth rate for the rich. So to tell you to what extent this decline in inequality is large, what I'm going to do is to compare the growth rate of the income of the poor and the rich in Brazil. And that's the graph that we come up with. And this graph is telling you the following. The average growth rate for Brazil was about 2.5% per year. This is a per capita growth rate for the 2001-2006 period. Okay? Well, the bottom 10% was growing at 9%. And the top 10 was growing at 1.5%. So actually, the four bottom tenths of the distribution were all of them growing faster than 5% per year. So despite the growth rate of overall Brazil being 2.5% per year, more than 100 million people were actually having their income growing faster than 5% per year. How can you have a country where this sizable number of people are growing very fast, well, you have a reduction in inequality. So you allow them to grow very fast, much faster than the average. Well, from this picture, you may say, well, the growth rate for the poor is nothing but 6 times greater than the growth rate for the poor. Then maybe from this picture, you may have an impression that, well, this means something significant. And that's not something that happens once. This happens every year. So I'm telling you that this is happening for a period of 5 consecutive years. This picture reproduces itself 5 years in a row. So that means the rich guys are looking at the poor guys, and the poor having a growth rate that's 6 times greater than the growth rate for the rich. Well, that's reduction in inequality. To make this a little bit more dramatic, I construct this graph here, which what I did was the following. I ranked 170 countries by their growth rate. Okay? So the height, all countries are ranked by their growth rate, and the height here is the growth rate of the country. So China is here, because China is one of the fast growing countries in the world. It's actually growing 8% per year. And AT is down here because AT is shrinking 3% per year. Okay? Well, Argentina with a per capita growth rate of 1% every year. Okay? So how if the bottom 10% of Brazil were a country, where these poor people would locate? Well, they would be here. They will be growing faster than China. And the top 10% of Brazil will be where? Here, close to Senegal and Argentina. So because of the reduction in inequality in Brazil, the rich in Brazil feel like they are in Argentina. And the poor in Brazil feel like they are in China. That's the difference. And that's explained by the reduction in inequality. Well, you'd like to have more reduction in inequality, think this is not enough, then you want to have a country where these two little balls are further apart, because that's the only way you can have a greater reduction in inequality. If you can have a sustainable country that will not turn into a civil war, and you have a country where some people are growing like China, and the other people are growing like Argentina, and the guys that are growing like Argentina are the poor, I mean, you really have a very decent level of inequality reduction. So I'm just mapping 1% of Gini reduction into differential growth, and you can see that 1% reduction in the Gini coefficient may looks nothing, but when you translate it in the difference in growth between the rich and poor, it's a lot, and you cannot expect more than that. Well, but you may not be convinced, because you may say, well, if I care about inequality, I care about inequality because inequality leads to poverty reduction. So let me see if this huge inequality reduction that you were talking about actually led to a huge decline in poverty. Let me show you what happens to poverty in Brazil. So this is the graph of poverty in Brazil. And over this period, extreme poverty in Brazil went down by 6.7 percent points in 5 years. Then you may say, well, if we're used to this kind of data, you would know that any reduction in extreme poverty greater than 1 percentage point per year, it's a lot. So this is much greater than 1 percentage point per year, so that's a lot. But it's not clear from this graph that we are doing a great thing in terms of reducing extreme poverty. So I decided to make some comparisons to show you how fast is this decline in poverty. And I'm going to try to convince you that this reduction in extreme poverty is extremely fast. How can I do that? Well, we know that all countries in the world, they signed the Millennium Development Goal. And the Millennium Development Goal asks every country to reduce extreme poverty to a half by 2015, considering the starting level 1990. So you have 25 years to reduce your extreme poverty to one half. Well, is this a tough goal? Well, if you go to New York and if you go to the UNDP office, you're going to see probably 50 people there just doing research why most countries in the world will not be able to meet the first Millennium Development Goal. So it seems to be a tough job to do that. So how does speed of Brazil compare to the speed that Brazil would require to meet the first development goal? Well, where is the first development goal for Brazil? It's here. So this is the, down here, I have the first Millennium Development Goal for Brazil. The point is, Brazil has already met the Millennium Development Goal by 2006. We have already reduced extreme poverty to a half. We have done that 9 years before schedule. You may say, well, that may happen because we did many things before 2001. So what I put here, this blue line here, this red line here, is telling you what need to be the rate when Brazil signed this agreement. What was the rate that actually Brazil was assuming the compromise? And Brazil assumed publicly the compromise should move along this red line here. So Brazil would, if you can extrapolate this for extra 10 years, and you can see that that will cross this red line down here. So that was what Brazil was promising. So this line here means to reduce extreme poverty to one half in 25 years. Translate into this setup here, give you this one. Well, what's the conclusion here? Brazil now is actually reducing extreme poverty three times faster than what would be required to meet the first development goal. So it's three times faster. But then you say, well, okay, but what this has to do with inequality? Because some of this reduction in poverty comes from growth. So maybe most of this reduction in poverty came from growth, and actually the reduction in poverty was not so important. So to finish this, what I did was a simulation, where I simulate this blue line is what actually happened to inequality in Brazil. But what actually happened to inequality in Brazil depends on what happens to, this is what happens to extreme poverty in Brazil, and what happens to extreme poverty in Brazil depends on what happens to economic growth and what happens to inequality. So what they did was to freeze the per capita income and simulate what would be the evolution of poverty, what would be the evolution of extreme poverty, if the only thing going on were the reduction of 1.2% of the Gini coefficient every year. And the picture looked like this. Is this green line here. This green line here is how inequality would, how extreme poverty would decline if per capita income stayed the same. So that means that only that reduction in inequality that we have in Brazil would have reduced extreme poverty over this period by 4.2 percentage points, which is twice as much as the Millennium Development Goal requires. So this decline in inequality, it's large enough that allows Brazil to reduce poverty just by the reduction in inequality twice as fast as what would be required by for meeting the Millennium Development Goal. So it's just telling you that that reduction in inequality actually has a huge impact on poverty, actually makes the growth rate for the poor to grow much faster than growth, make the growth rate for the poor to be much faster than growth rate for the rich, and then led to a substantial decline in poverty. So the question is, to what extent what was the cause of this, and to what extent is this sustainable? Are we in a sustainable path? Can this be reproduced year after year? If I can have time, I can come back later and show you that for Brazil, if you define in a way that I can show to you later if we have time,
what would be a decent level of inequality for Brazil, even at this speed, would take Brazil 25 years to reach a decent level of inequality. Okay? We can talk about that later, but the whole idea here is that the message here is that Brazil is moving very fast, but it's so far behind that actually need to move that fast for a long period of time to actually reach a decent level of inequality. So the conclusion is that this is all fine and beautiful, but we actually need this to be sustainable for it to be really valuable for the country and for the poor. So, to see if it's sustainable, we start looking at what was the causes behind this sharp decline in inequality. One thing that we learned very quickly was the fact that there was not at all a single cause for this decline in inequality. Some people were unhappy, but I think most people were extremely happy to know that many, many things happened to explain this decline in inequality. Because if I have a single cause, it would be very hard to imagine that to be a basis for a sustainable process. If I tell you that the GDP, the per capita GDP of Brazil is growing because we are just selling more airplanes or because the price of corn went up, you not claim that that would be a sustainable way of growing. But if the growth is related to what's going on in many different sectors and we cannot really tell exactly what is generating that growth, then maybe bad for social science, but it may be very good for sustainability of growth because it's something very intricate and then that they can really... If a single, multiple causes may not be synonymous, may not be sufficient for sustainability, but it's probably quite necessary for sustainability. So when we analyze this, we're going to see many causes. Okay? So I tried to organize this a little bit. And to organize this a little bit, simple expression here, the simple identity, helps a lot. Because it tells you that for each family, the per capita income of every family can be written as this simple expression, that the per capita income is equal to D, which is a percentage of adults, times the income per adult. So the per capita income is the income per adult multiplied by the percentage of adults in the family. But the income per adult can be divided in the non-labor income per adult, where I have transfers, remittances, inter-family transfers, government transfers, and the labor income per adult. But the labor income per adult by itself can be divided in the proportion of adults that actually work and the average labor income of adults that actually work. This can be done for every family. Although all the four things here are interrelated, they are interrelated, but they represent four completely different set of factors. The D is the demographics. Of course, demographics is related to the economics, but here's the demographics. Here I have the government transfers. Here I have labor supply and the creation of jobs. And here I have something like labor productivity related to human capital and improvements in the quality of jobs. So if this is true for each and every family, if this expression is true for each and every family, then the distribution of Y, the distribution of income, is a function and can be determined by the joint distribution of these four objects. There's no way the distribution of income can change if the joint distribution of these four objects do not change. So the exercise we did was formed. Well, we went to search where were the from where the changes came from. So what we did, we start with the joint distribution of these four objects for 2001. And then we say, well, we have the distribution of these four objects that's made by the marginal distribution of the four objects plus the association between these four objects. So what we keep doing were like taking apart one piece from 2001 and plug in a piece from 2005. So like we take the marginal distribution of D from 2001 and plug the marginal distribution for 2005. So we keep changing this distribution for 2001 in such a way that we start with 2001, it becomes most of it 2001, a little bit of 2005, up to a situation that becomes most of it 2005, a little bit of 2001, and at the end we reach 2005. So we follow a path changing pieces of the distribution. What we do at each step, we measure the Gini coefficient. Well, if that piece that we have changed is important, then the inequality, when we make that change, will drop, okay? Because we know we're going to start from 2001 with high inequality and get 2005 with low inequality. So sometimes inequality reduces just a little bit, sometimes it reduces a lot. When it reduces a lot, we know we reach one object that were important. Well, the results are in this table. You can see here the changes. So we got, you start from 59.3, and you have to reach 55.9. And then the first change actually increases inequality. The second one decreases just a little bit. The third one decreases a little bit. Then you have a sharp decline. Then an increase. Then a little decrease. And then a sharp decline. Where we reach the sharp declines, where we reach the sharp decline when we did two things. We change the distribution of non-labor income. And we change the distribution of income among workers. The demographics were not important, and job generation were not important. There was no job generation in this period in Brazil? No. Actually, labor force participation increased a lot, and a lot of jobs were created. But the point is that those jobs were not preferably assigned to the poor people. So we're talking about inequality, not about job generation. If the jobs are generated but they don't reach the very poor, they are not going to explain why the income of the very poor grow faster than the income of the very rich. So actually, we discovered that the non-labor income and the labor income were the main determinants. Okay, I'm going to talk more about the non-labor income later on. Let me talk briefly about the labor income. So the labor income was a major part of the story. The labor income explained 40% of that decline. Well, we know that the labor income is deeply related to education and 10 years ago when I was describing why inequality in Brazil was so large, I was telling you exactly the inequality is very large in Brazil because education is very unequally distributed in Brazil, and the wage gap between educated and uneducated workers in Brazil is huge. So if you have a very unequal distribution of something, and that something is very valuable, then you are you necessarily are led to a very high level of inequality. So the question is, what happens to the value of education? What happens to the wage gap between skilled and unskilled workers? And what happens to the inequality of education among the labor force? And look what happens to the wage gap between skilled and unskilled. So this is the how much an extra year of education would increase your wage in Brazil. Well, it's going down from 14 to 12. It's still a very high number. Probably for the U.S. would be something like 9. For Taiwan could be probably 8. For Brazil it's 12. It's very high, but it's going down. So that means the wage premium for the educated people went down. So we reduce
the gap. But more importantly, after 2001, this is the path of the inequality in education in the labor force in Brazil. So inequality was, the inequality of the education of the labor force was going up 2001, after 2001 it started going down. And when this thing starts going down, you go down almost forever. Because this is a turning point that actually, once you move this point, you're going to go down. So what is going on now in Brazil is that the labor force is becoming more homogeneous educationally, and the premium for education is going up. This helped to explain the decline in inequality? Sure. The price effect, the decline in the gap between skilled and unskilled workers, actually contributes to 11% for the decline in inequality in Brazil. In the sense that if this gap had not been reduced, 11% of the decline in inequality would be lost. And 4% of the decline in inequality came from this reduction in inequality of workers in terms of their education. We have some interaction between the two factors. They add together to 17%. So remember, 39% of the decline in inequality in Brazil was due to reduction in the inequality of labor income. So, almost half of that is related to education. So what the other half is related to what? Well, we search a little bit, and one thing that may happen is that, well, there are other wage differentials in the labor market, wage differentials between blacks and whites, between men and women, between urban areas and rural areas, between different sectors and so on. So we start looking what happens to all those differentials and which of those differentials actually went down very quickly. And one very interesting thing that we didn't suspect at all, and this graph presents to us, is that over this period in Brazil, we had a very significant reduction of the wage gap between observably equal workers in the big cities and the small cities of the interior. Typically, Brazil, it's a country where you have a lot of migration from little towns in the interior to the big towns. Well, over the past 10 years, the gap between the wages in these two areas reduced a lot. And that was a change within states. It's not that the little cities in the northeast of Brazil get closer to the big cities of the southeast of Brazil. No, inside the São Paulo state, the small cities get very close to the capital city. And this is a very interesting process and requires a lot of studies, because some people say this is a consequence of trade liberalization. Then firms move to the interior of the country to seek for to gain competitiveness, because they are moving away from the unions to the interior. And this is now possible because education now is reaching those areas, so you could have educated workers in those areas. You could not have done that movement 20 years ago because you didn't have the educated labor force there. Now you can do it. Other people say that this is just a minimum wage policy. You increase the minimum wage, wages go up more in the interior than in the capital. Other people say this is a shift in the, this is an indirect consequence of the large increase in government transfers. What the Brazilian government did was to transfer a lot of income to the poor in the very remote areas. Well, if those poor guys with this extra income start buying things, they're going to press up the price for goods in those areas, and actually the benefit for them will be not all that great because the prices are going to go up, but the wages of many of public people providing services in those areas may go up too. But that was an important thing. Many things happen. The agriculture
wages improve a lot. We have a very large improvement in agricultural productivity. But at the end, all these notions of labor market imperfections on a whole, they decline, and they explain something like 13% of the decline. So this 13 plus the other 20 from education, we come up with 33%, which is almost the 39% that we have explained. It's important to notice that the decline in inequality in Brazil was not led by a reduction in race differential. It was not the black-white differential that was actually reducing inequality in Brazil. Those gaps actually remain quite constant. It was not male-female earnings gap that went down. Okay? It was mainly sectoral gaps that went down. And an important thing, the formal-informal gap was not contributing at all. So it was not the case the formal and informal sectors approach each other, quite the opposite. And this would be related to our social policy, because this was a period with a huge increase in taxes and a very large increase in government expenditure. So actually, was not very good for the formal sector. So actually, the formal-informal sector gaps actually increased over this period, and this was not one of the reasons why inequality went down. So this kind of methodology allows you to search and see where inequality actually, which factors contribute more and less for this reduction in inequality. Okay, up to this point, this may look like a very nice story where everything were all right, and everything that was done was perfect, and inequality was going down, poverty was going down, and everything is perfect. Well, let me tell you that the story is not like that at all, and it's very important to realize that if you want to have sustainability. What happens in Brazil, if we can characterize it that way, was a government that suddenly had a lot of money, because the government discovered that he could increase taxes. So actually, he increased tax a lot. Not just Lula government, but Fernando Henrique government, and the previous 10 years in Brazil, we have been increasing taxes a lot. And the government has been spending a lot. And how the government has been solving the dilemma between people that propose such policies and people that propose the other policies? They say, let's do both. So some people say, well, we should do a very well-targeted transfer program that really reach the poor, that is really targeted on children, that should really enhance human capital, and should be very efficient. Then the government say, well, let's do that. And they will check if you were very efficient and if you were everything. The other guy will tell you, we don't need to be efficient. We don't need to target anything. We should give money to all the elderly in the country for whatever reason. They don't have to pay bus rides. They don't have to pay anything. We don't have to be efficient. And then the government says, yes, we have to do that. So give money to those guys too. And for them, we don't check if they're efficient, because they said they don't have to be efficient. So what we have now in Brazil, it's a mixture of everything. Because we don't have budget constraints. So how do you solve the conflict between people with different views of social policy? We do everything. Okay. So we have, each state in Brazil has 100 social policies, 100 social programs, and we have 27 states, and the federal government has an extra 100 social programs. So if we imagine a program, a social program, I would doubt if that program is not there in Brazil somewhere. So we do have it, and that's not special about Brazil.
Mexico is like that, and talking to people in India, they say, well, India is the same thing, and they have millions of problems. What's the good thing and the bad thing about Brazil depends on whether you were a pessimistic or optimistic person. The point is, now, the government is facing a hard budget constraint. From now on, he realized that he has to limit the amount of taxes, and the government just have enormous loss in Congress when he tries just to keep all taxes in place. People cut taxes. So the government now has a hard budget constraint. Well, is this bad? Well, it depends if the government can make decisions. The good thing about Brazil is that we have so much bad policy that we have huge amount of room for shifting from bad policies to good policies with a budget balance and make poverty to go down and make inequality to go down. But to do that, you have really to make difficult choices. So let me try to explain to you two choices about Brazil. One is between the elderly and the children. And I think it's not different from the US. Like in Brazil, all the elderly can ride on the buses for free, and the students cannot. So we allow the students have to pay, and the elderly don't have to pay. Not everywhere. But let me show you a very important bias in Brazilian social policy. Well, here I have a graph where in this X I have age. So this children, 0 to 10, and this the elderly, 65 to 80. And this is the level of poverty, so this is the poverty headcount. After the government has charged you with taxes, before the government has transferred you any income. So this is the how the poverty life cycle profile look like before government transfers. Well, I'm giving you a hint. I'm giving you an information about where will be the poverty rate after government transfers. Will be along this yellow line. This will be the average poverty rate for the country after government transfer. Well, you can see the government is transferring a lot. Right? Actually, the Brazilian government is transferring like 15% of GDP to families. Okay? So it's a considerable amount for a developing country, 15% of GDP being transferred from the government to families. Okay, so that's a lot, and that's why it can take care of this huge blue area. Okay, but if you were a government and you want to transfer this amount of money, how would you like poverty to look like after the transfer? Well, a very rational government would say, well, I want it flat, like this line here. All groups will have the same poverty after I make the transfer. I will eliminate this excess poverty for the elderly and this excess poverty for the children. Well, a government that's looking a little bit ahead and say, well, I was going to tilt this a little bit and going to benefit children a little bit more because after all, children will be the workers of the future. So let's reduce a little bit more the poverty among children and let the poverty among the elderly be a little bit above average because I'm trying to favor some investment on children. So what does the Brazilian government? Comes the Brazilian government with this gigantic truck full of money, give the money to these people, and look at the final level of poverty in the country. It's like this. So if you put the two together, you get this. So where do you see poverty among children? It's like this. How is the poverty among the elderly? It's like this. What is this? Government transfer. Because one guy asked the government to give, one people asked the government to give 400 reais for every elderly, and government gave. The other guy said, well, we should give money to the children for investment in human capital, but we don't need to give more than 15 reais. And they said, okay, give 15 reais to the children. So after we give 15 reais to the children, because you guys were very concerned about budget and being efficient, and you give 400 for the elderly, because the other guys didn't care much about efficient, at the end we have that. What happens over the past years? This is how much extreme poverty were reduced. But look, extreme poverty were reduced among children, but look how much extreme poverty were reduced among the elderly. So we are reducing poverty among the elderly, even though poverty among the elderly was already small. Look at the situation today. It's ridiculous. That's the age profile of poverty. Remember, it was 11% I present to you. Well, it's 11% for the country, but it's 20% for children. And it's basically zero for the elderly. Because if you're just an old person, you just go to the government, they're going to give you a pension that will take you out of poverty. Okay? So, with a budget, you have to fix this, and you have to tax these people somehow, reduce their benefits, and increase these benefits. And remember, you have much more people here than here. Okay? What people in Brazil claim is that, what people that like this say, well, this worked very good, so we should do this for everyone in Brazil. Well, the point is that would cost another 20% of GDP. Okay? So that's not feasible. That's very nice, but cannot be done. So the question is how you are going to recover this children that only receive very efficient programs. How you are going to reshuffle your budget. That's one example. The other example is the minimum wage. Now, Brazil has a very strange law where the minimum wage is related to growth on GDP, not per capita GDP, GDP. If the GDP goes up by 4%, the minimum wage should go up by 4%. People are estimating when the minimum wage will be higher than the average wage in Brazil. Because it will not take long. Because if you go up by national GDP, not per capita GDP, I mean, it's strange, but that's what they're doing. And they say, well, that was reducing inequality. And that's true. I mean, if we increase the minimum wage, reduce inequality, reduce poverty. The question is, how much would that cost? And can you keep doing that? So I have this graph where what we did was form this line here. What we have here in this X is the income of the bottom 10%, income of the bottom 20%, income of the bottom 30%, 40%, 50%, and so on. So we are talking about the average income of the bottom of the distribution. Okay, because we know that for distribution and matters, that's what's important. Okay? Well, then, this minimum wage line here, it's what would be the impact of a 10% increase in the minimum wage on the income of the poor? And you can see that would not benefit much the very poor, but we'll increase the income of a bunch of people here. Okay? So, there is no question that an increase in 10% of minimum wage will increase the income of the bottom 20%, of the bottom 10%, of the bottom 30%, the bottom 40%, and so on. And just for your information, all the pensions of the elderly are linked to the minimum wage. They cannot be lower than minimum wage. And the pension for the children, the guys that design programs that we never should link this to minimum wage, and the president says, yes, that's true. That's what we should do. So it's not, it's de-linked to the minimum wage. So when the minimum wage goes up, the pensions of the elderly goes up, the pension, the benefits of the children stays the same. Okay, because one is linked, the other one is not linked. Okay? Okay, but suppose what they did here, suppose instead of spending this money with the minimum wage, you spend this money with this very well targeted human capital enhancing program that Brazil has. Brazil has a program that's called Bolsa Família. That's one of the reasons of the success of our social policy. That give something like $7 each child every minute, every month. $7 for each child every month. And you may say that's nothing, but actually it has an enormous impact on human capital accumulation, has an enormous impact on nutrition, has an enormous impact on poverty, and actually it's functioning very well. And the point is, if we just take this money that we're using for increasing minimum wage, and we send this money
to exactly the same people that already receive this Bolsa Família program. What would be the impact on the average income of the bottom 10%? Well, the impact would be like this. Same money. Same money has this impact on the bottom 10, has this impact on the bottom 10 if you go to Bolsa Família. It doesn't matter how you cut poverty, it's always higher here than here. That means that it doesn't matter how you measure inequality, it doesn't matter how you measure poverty, it doesn't matter how you choose a poverty line. Using this money for this Bolsa Família program will always be better than using this money increasing the minimum wage. Then you say, well, then it's trivial that the government will shift from one situation to the other. But then I construct a different graph that can tell you why it may be not that easy. And what they did was following. Here, it sounds ridiculous, because if I accumulate from the poor, doesn't matter how I define the poor, giving this money to the to families with children, it's all better than to increase the minimum wage. Why anybody would choose to increase the minimum wage? But everybody in Brazil is actually talking about increasing minimum wage, not giving this money to the children. So I was wondering why. So I did the formula. I did an exercise that I didn't know what the answer would be, but ended up being very nice, where I accumulate, instead of accumulating from the poor, and say, well, suppose the government is not concerned with the average income of the poor. But suppose he is interested in the average income of the middle of the distribution. So what they did was to accumulate, not from the poor, but from the middle. You open a window in the middle, and then you keep opening the window, and you keep looking at the average income of the middle. And then you look, what's the impact of the minimum wage? Is this big? What's the impact of the program that goes to the poor children? Well-targeted program, going to be very poor children, very small, because poor children are not in the middle of the distribution. And the people that actually receive these pensions and receive minimum wage in the formal sector in Brazil are in the middle of the distribution. So actually, if you want to maximize income of people at the middle of distribution, you should do minimum wage. If you want to increase income of people at the bottom of distribution, you should do Bolsa Família. What the Brazilian government is doing very smartly is doing both. So we can increase the income of the poor, and then we can increase the income of people at the middle of the distribution. The point is, when you have a budget, and you can only do one thing, can you really shift from paying attention to the middle to pay attention to the bottom to the distribution? So I think this is the main dilemma for Brazil and many Latin American countries, that no doubt Brazil, Mexico, and other countries, they have been able to reduce inequality and reduce poverty substantially. But in the case of Brazil, it's very clearly that we have done that by increasing social expenditures and increasing all types of programs. If we want to make this decline in inequality and decline in poverty sustainable, from now on, we have to make choices. And the advantage for Brazil, as I was mentioning before, is that we have plenty of room, because actually we have many policies full of money that we can actually change to other policies that are much more effective. So up to, we are very far from our frontier of possibilities. We are very inefficient. So we have all the space to do that, but to do that will require very, very difficult choices between benefiting the elderly against children, middle class, against the very poor, and we can give millions of examples like public universities and many other housing programs and things like that, who gets benefits and how rearranging expenditures we can reduce inequality. Okay, thank you.
Where does Brazil get the just do whatever social program any person comes up with. So if you know they have conflicting social programs, they just do both. Where is all that money coming from?
Tax. We have a large increase in taxes, and now the government is getting something like 30% of 33% of GDP now goes to the government, and it used to be less than that. So we have an increase in taxes, and in the future, you may have also, well, we are also moving a lot of investments in infrastructure to social programs. So a lot of people that are concerned about economic growth are very concerned that we're not investing as much in roads, harbors, and other things, general infrastructure, and we are spending a lot on social programs. So we have lost things that you have to spend this much on health, this much on education, this much on such and such programs, and taxes are just going up. But we have, probably we have already reached a limit. We have one possible escape is that we still have a very large government debt, and we pay a lot of interest on this debt. To the extent that this debt is going down, and to the extent that interest rates going down, probably we can save a lot of money from paying interest and paying the debt, and then that will release some money that we can use more.
I have two quick questions. I read an article on the New York Times saying that a lot of Brazilians that had immigrated to the United States are now going back to Brazil. Is that affecting the economics of Brazil now, or do you see it affecting the economics? And then also, the ethanol production in Brazil has almost skyrocketed in the last few years. Is that affecting the economics as well? The ethanol production?
Uh-huh.
How is that affecting the economics? Those are my questions.
Well, I cannot answer you because my feeling is that neither, but just my feeling, I have no study to show you, but I think the migration for Brazil, it's too small to have an impact. And the ethanol industry, it may have a huge impact in the future, but still, we don't have a sizable effect on the Brazilian economy. But the ethanol industry may have a very big impact on the Brazilian economy in the future.
I guess it's two questions. The first is, you talked about the choices we have to do between elderly people and children and middle and poor. And how about the choice between rich, very rich, and the poor? The second point linked to the first one. Does it mean the fact that you doesn't put this in the equation? Into the equation means that the rich are doing bad now in Brazil. They are overtaxed or something like that.
Well, the point is, that's a very important question, a very important point. The social policy in Brazil, it's smart enough that it's actually not giving money to the rich. It's actually giving money. It takes someone that's very poor and give that guy a huge amount of money. I mean, some money that will make a very poor guy to be well above the average for the country. So you can say, are you not going to help this very poor old person? And you say, sure, I have to help this very poor old person. But I cannot give to that person this much money because I don't have this much money to give to every poor person in Brazil. So the difficult thing about the social policy in Brazil is that they're not giving money to the rich. They're actually giving money to the lower middle class, to the poor, but then they choose a subgroup of the poor, and they give them a lot of money.
You are suggesting the tax
the elderly poor.
So what I'm saying is exactly that. I'm saying instead of giving those guys 400, I mean 400 reais means $200 per month. You say, well, you're not going to give $200 per month for a poor elderly. It's like if they can give to all poor people in Brazil $200, I'll be happy to do it. But if I'm in a country, well, what Brazil is doing is the former. Brazil spends with an elderly 400 in a month. His grandson is going to school, and the government is spending less than 100 with the school of that child. So which country is that? That's giving 400 as a transfer, a monetary transfer to the others, and spending 100 on the education of their grandson. You say, well, I would love to give 400 for the others, as long as I'm spending 500 with the children's education. But if I'm spending 100 with children's education, why am I spending 400 with the others? But that's a difficult thing, because if I were giving 400 for the rich, everybody would say, well, take the 400 from the rich and give to the poor, that would not be a problem. The problem is, it's a delicate thing, because you have to look like with the microscope and say, well, I'm giving 400, but 400 is too much, because I'm giving 15 to the children. The children give 15, and to the other, I give 400. And the education of the child, I spend 100. So this, it's a little bit unbalanced. So it's a tough question, because we are talking about taking money from the lower middle class and giving the money to the very poor. Because that's the way you're going to get efficiency. Many people say before, well, let's not do that. Let's tax the rich and solve this problem. Some people say the following, let's tax the rich, keep the elderly with 400, tax the rich, and send money to the poor. The cost of that, to equalize this stuff, will be something like $200 billion a year. So there's no way you can tax the... So the point is, Brazil is already being so generous with some groups. There is no way it can equalize it can level the field, because it's giving so much help to some groups that if it's trying to level this to everybody in the country, to make this a universal policy, everybody in Brazil, so if you are a middle class guy, you go to a college, and the entire college is free. And you say, well, then let's calculate the cost of that. And let's give this amount of money to all the youth in Brazil for them to start their life. I mean, some people may want to go to college, some people want to open a new business. If you compute the cost of that, it's $150 billion. So the point of the Brazilian social policy that the Brazilian social policy choose some subgroups, gave to them such a large benefit that now it's impossible to generalize those benefits to everybody in the country. Yeah, no.
I was puzzled, not for the first time actually, by the fact that you only consider when the transfers from the government plus the wage, plus the returns from wages. But do you consider in those transfers, for instance, the interest rates that rich people are getting for their money, that go between 11 and 12% a year, right, with no risk whatsoever. So I'm confused. Because it seems to me that rich people are getting much more than 2.5% growth a year if you include the interest rates that these people are getting from whom? From the government. So are you including that factor in your analysis, or are you not? That's what I'm asking.
I am in an imperfect way in this data that I present here. But 2 points. One is that that's such an important issue in Brazil that actually Gabriel and I and Samir, we wrote an entire long paper exactly compiling all information from national accounts and different expenditure surveys and so on, trying to measure this. And our conclusion is that, of course, if you include all this other income, probably inequality would be a little bit higher. Okay? But man, Brazil, it's already the champion of inequality in the world without including those things. And the data that we have for Brazil is considered internationally a very, very good quality data. So all the other countries in the world actually have similar data. So nobody actually have very detailed data on capital income. But for us, what matters is actually the change over time. And so we did several simulations imputing this kind of income and knowing how much of that income is available in the country from the national accounts. We did many simulations. And the result of that is that it's not clear at all that over this period, the income of the rich is going up because of that. And mainly because interest rates have been going up. Well, it's very high, but the interest rate is very high, but it's going down. And what it matters, well, the point is, it's very true that we are dramatically underestimating the income of the rich. And all countries have that. In Brazil, it's already a very high inequality country, even when we ignore this capital income of the very rich. But there's nothing that happens in Brazil over the past 5 years that actually benefits these transfers from government to the rich, because interest rates were not going up and they are facing much more competition from foreign capital and so on. So it doesn't seem that that would explain the rich to be happy saying, well, actually our income is going up very much. I mean, they still, and remember, I said the per capita income of the poor grow 6 times faster than the per capita income of the rich. But in absolute terms, the per capita income of the rich, in dollar terms, the per capita income of the rich is going faster than the per capita income of the poor. Because the rich has an income that's 25 times greater. So even if something that's 25 times greater grow at a smaller rate, the dollar amount is much bigger. So actually, in dollar terms, the actual income of the rich in Brazil is still going up faster than the income of the poor. But in relative terms, the poor is going faster.
But could you estimate, like the, you know, you mentioned 2.5% growth for the richest, let's say,
1.5 for the rich.
Yeah. Could you estimate how that? I mean, if you include capital income, how much it would come to?
Well, we have not done that. Maybe it's possible, but the point is, including capital income is not going to change much the rate at which the income of the poor is growing. It changes a lot the size of the income, not the rates of growth. Because there's no reason why the richer in Brazil is actually getting richer faster. They used to gain a lot with the, during the inflationary period, they were earning much more from having financial capital that they are earning now. When the Brazilian capital account was closed, they were earning much more than now that the capital account is open. So actually, they are losing power, not the gain.
Yes, Ricardo. I enjoyed very much your presentation. I just would like you to comment on the, on these different policies. I understand there is one of them that you talk about positively, which is the Bolsa Família. At least from what I understand, your assessment is very positive. Among all the social policies that are nowadays adopted in Brazil, are there other ones that you find are, say, efficient and fair, that you think, you know, from your critical approach, would deserve to be either improved or be kept in the future?
The big example, probably the nice example about contradiction in Brazil, it's college education. In Brazil, we have a big confusion between public run institutions, like state institutions, and public institutions. So the building where I live is next to a federal university. And I cannot enter the university, despite the university being public. They say they're public, but they cannot really cross. Take a big turn to go to one place to the other because they are in the middle. They cannot even cross their area. So I don't think they are very public, but they say they're public. Well, they state enterprise. Okay. So in Brazil, they create a new program. So what we do now in Brazil is the following. If you pass an exam, if you want a meritocratic society, you should have something like, I pass an exam, it doesn't matter where I go, I see the tuition, right? Surprisingly, when Brazil sends students abroad, they don't ask if the university are sending students a public or private, they just pay the tuition or don't pay the tuition depending if it's expensive or inexpensive, they don't care, right? If you are a good student, I'm going to pay for your education. Okay? It doesn't matter if you go to a public or a private institution. In Brazil, I only pay you if you go to a public institution. So it's not a public institution, it's a state-owned university. So if you go to a state-owned university to pass, I give you free tuition. Well, so it's a crazy system because what happens is that only the rich guys, or mostly the rich guys, pass the exam. So only the rich guys actually receive that education, and they don't. And this is crowding out completely the expenditure that parents would spend on their children. So my son passed one of those exams, and I had some money that I saved for him. I said, "Well, now what I should do with this money?" So I paid him to go to Europe and spend a month in France. I said, "Well, and buy a car because I don't have to pay your education anymore. The government is paying everything." Because they're just crowding out private investment. Okay? What the government did, in one policy, they create something that's called ProUni. It's a wonderful idea. They create a program that's like a formal. Every university in Brazil that claim they are non-profit have to give some vacancies for the government. The government has a national exam only among poor students, now it's among poor, for the state schools, for the state universities. It can be poor, rich, doesn't matter. For the ProUni, you have to be poor. It's a national exam, poor students, you pass the exam, you receive your full tuition for the entire period, plus sometimes a stipend. The perfect program. On the other hand, the government is building more than state-owned, very inefficient universities all over the place. So it's a case where you were kind of privatizing college education on the one hand, and in the other hand, and give priority access to the poor. In the other hand, you were kind of doing exactly the opposite, which is a traditional thing. So if you want a very nice example of a very good policy, I would say the ProUni, it's an excellent example of a policy.
This is just a clarification. You mentioned then that inequality
is going down across sectors, but not across genders?
No, it's going down across genders, but not very much. So it doesn't explain much of the, maybe explain 1% of the decline in inequality in Brazil.
And is this across entire distribution or only amongst the poor?
No, in the entire distribution, the difference between men and women is going down, but it's going down very, very slightly. So it's not a, it's not something that we were very effective in reducing over this period.
Well, actually, in the meantime, I have a question, which is one of the most stunning things in the report on which your talk is based is that the demographic variable, only accounted for 2% of the reduction in inequality in this period. I was really stunned by that. And do you anticipate that looking 10 or 15 years into the future, the demographic variable will still be so trivial as part of the equation?
Well, the problem with the demographics is actually we have very little reduction because we are talking about inequality reduction. So actually we have some reductions in fertility and family size, but actually that reduction was not very differentiated between the poor and the rich. So because we have a kind of a homogeneous decline, the contribution were relatively small. And the book we published, actually there's one demographer that actually wrote an entire chapter trying to see what extent demographic variables could explain more if you were more sophisticated about the demographics. And the conclusion seems to be that demographics were not very important at all.
Could you say a few more words about what's going on in the macro economy as a whole? I mean, for example, the GDP growth could be decomposed into the growth of the factors as well as total factor productivity, but and I don't know what's big and what's small in Brazil, but beyond that, is it shrinking agriculture, increasing sector in manufacturing? And finally, get to the inequality. So Brazil, like a few other countries, seems to be a country where the unskilled are benefiting from increases in wages. But certainly, if you juxtapose it with the U.S. and many industrialized countries, we're getting these increasing, not decreasing, skill premia. So what is your forecast for Brazil's future?
I would not. Let me mention one thing here that may be related to your question. You're asking probably too many things that I cannot answer. I will not try to answer you what exactly would be the macroeconomic, how to summarize this macroeconomic environment for Brazil here, but. But let me show you one thing that I think may be very problematic and important for and related to skill premium and labor productivity in Brazil. And this is the form. Here I'm moving from the beginning to the end of the distribution. And here I have the increase in family income. And here I have the increase in labor income. And the first thing you can see that the increase in family income is greater than the increase in labor income. That means that this is a period with a considerable amount of transfers. So half of this decline in poverty and inequality is transfers. So actually not related to any real change in productivity and things like that. The complicated thing here is that when you go to this bottom here, you can see that here the wages are really going up, not very much here, but down here we are having problems. So what this is telling us is that the way the economics of different sectors is working, it's in a way that this group here, and this near poor group, I being able to increase their productivity, but the actual productivity of the very poor and not being able to increase and actually taking them out of poverty mainly by transfers. So it's a complicated way to fight poverty and inequality because the very poor are actually benefiting much more from transfers than actually from increase in labor productivity. And we actually are showing the all social policies in Brazil and the economic policies are having a hard time to reach the productivity in the very poor sector. So actually, the wages in agriculture are going up on average a lot. But probably the wages on the very poor segment of agriculture is probably not going up. So all the evidence we have is that we have done that with many different sectors. Is that if you take any sector and the lower tail of the distribution, you are not being able to reach them. So actually, we are having a hard time improving the productivity of the very bad jobs in the country. But in terms of sectors, the only major thing that shows up over this period is a major improvement in income in agriculture. All the other sectors, it's a kind of a mixture. But you have this informal, formal sector that it's not clear because the gap between the formal and informal sector went up. But it's a period where you were increasing taxes and you are not being very friendly with the formal sector.
Two more questions.
Excellent presentation. I enjoyed it. I had a couple of takeaways from interesting statistics that came out from your identity formula where you were showing some of the causal factors. And one was education, which made sense. But as, one you just touched on briefly that I thought was really interesting was the when you measured the formal versus informal economy, it actually had a negative correlation to any improvement in the inequality gap. And I don't maybe if you could comment on that, because there's a lot of focus on how to fine-tune social policies, but in fact, the and I don't know if people realize how large the informal economy is in Brazil, but it's people who stay away from doing business legitimately because taxes are so high, regulations are terrible. It's very difficult to do business in Brazil, and wouldn't we be better off, or maybe what your thoughts on putting more time into reforming contract law and reducing regulations so some of those people in the informal economy would participate in the formal economy, creating more jobs for even the unskilled, and maybe that would close the gap as well.
Yeah, for sure. One area where we can move from bad policies to good policies can reduce poverty and reduce inequality is exactly on this formal, informal area. We have crazy labor laws that date from the 1940s and they're still there. So we have plenty of room for changing the laws and have a major reduction in inequality and poverty. But it seems this is one of the areas that it's very hard to move on. But my feeling is that what we have to do is first of all to guarantee, we need laws like the formal. If you ask me how to do it, I'll tell you the formal first. You need money to guarantee that anybody that wants to register their firm can do it. If he doesn't have money, we pay for it. So it's like a birth certificate for a child. No child would be without a birth certificate because if the mother doesn't have the money, we pay for it. So if a firm is small, it doesn't have the money to register, We should have a program that will have a firm for the guy. The guy has no reason for being informal because they say, well, I'm informal because I don't have money to register my firm. No, I mean, I can register the firm for you. The second thing is, the guy says, well, I'm not going to register my firm because you have crazy laws. And then the problem with Brazil is how to deal with heterogeneity. We have firms of different size with different productivity, and we apply common rules to everyone. So the question is, then they are informal, we know that they exist, we do not recognize them, but we do not fight them. Why? Because we don't want to take any position that we think they are doing a social valuable contribution. So if a firm is informal and is doing a social valuable contribution to society, we should have a way to value that and say, okay, you can operate this way because I think that's good enough. That's below the standard I would like to have, but that's good enough. So I agree with you. So we should have not what we have in Brazil is like a step. Either you have no rules or you have to meet a gigantic number of rules. What we need is kind of a ladder saying that if you have this size of the firm, if you have this, you have to comply with this and this obligations and so on. But that would require the government to take a position on many things that today are illegal to become legal. And that's the thing that's difficult for the government. If the government does that, then we can make a lot of illegal firms, informal firms, formal, and then we can probably reduce this gap between formal and informal.
Do you have any measure about how this increasing growth in taxation harmed the economy overall in terms of growth? And the second one, do you know how the Bolsa Família changed the fertility decision of the young poor woman?
The decision of what?
The fertility decision. How many children they are going to have when you apply the Bolsa Escola, Bolsa Família?
Okay, well, I have no idea what the impact of taxation on growth. I'm not following the progress that a lot of people have been running models, but try to estimate what's the impact of that on growth, but they have not done. But in terms of the negative effect of what extent the Bolsa Família would increase fertility, I don't know of any study that have, at this point, found any positive effect. But I don't know. That's, I don't know. People have more, most people have studied the impact of Bolsa Família on labor supply. And the impact on labor supply is very close to zero. So we know that Bolsa Família has very little impact on, very little negative impact up to date on family decisions to work or not. Surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, the studies about the transfer to the elderly actually show a significant negative effect on the labor supply of youth. So people have been studying the impact of transfer income to the elderly on the labor supply of the youth that actually live with the elderly, and they found there's at least one PhD dissertation that found that they actually have a negative, the guy start working less than before, which we don't know if it's good or bad because the guy may be staying in school, so you don't know.
One more question?
Yeah. I mean, your analysis is very interesting, but this is a very short-run trend. You're talking about a few years. And I haven't seen a discussion of why you think this pattern is going to continue. Why you think, in fact, and so you have had some drop. The Gini coefficient's gone down a few points. But why can you extrapolate this for the next 20 years? I mean, this partly is related to the macro trends. Why is it you think this is going to be a persistent pattern that's going to hold for the next 10, 20 years?
Well, we don't know. My feeling is that the only way I'm more interested in the environment to be so important. I'm more concerned about how the Brazilian government are going to spend the money. The Brazilian government is spending 20% of GDP on social policy. My feeling is that for the future, it will be very hard for the Brazilian government to spend more than 20% of GDP on social programs. So my feeling is that the sustainability of this decline, okay, for the next 10 years will depend dramatically on the ability of the Brazilian government to shift, given the budget, to shift resources from more less effective programs to more effective programs. So what I have been studying is how can you reallocate a given budget to different programs, and by the reallocation of this money from different programs, I think even without much economic growth, if you just reallocate this money from different programs, you can gain so much efficiency in the social policy that you can sustain a sizable reduction in inequality and poverty. And the main reason for that is that what's really the real reason for, there are two ways you can increase the income of the poor. One way is to find a new path for the poor. You say, you are going to plant this, and you're going to export this, and you're going not to bother the rich guys that are doing something else. Well, the other way to increase the income of the poor, it's actually allowing the poor to compete with the rich for the jobs that are already available in the country. And my point is, without any economic growth, Brazil could have a much smaller level of inequality and a much smaller level of poverty if positions everywhere in the country were filled with much more equality of opportunity. So if you could have a social policy that could actually give better education and give more openness of the available good jobs in the country, actually you could promote more equality, and you could promote some reduction in poverty, even if without generating new jobs or changing much of the productivity of some jobs.
But over this period, you said there wasn't much of a contribution of change in discrimination, though. So that's not playing much of a role here. So you mean equality of opportunity, you mean in sort of long-term investment somehow. Is that the idea? Not, but discrimination played a very small component of changing the patterns.
Yeah, this, right? The discrimination plays... Even if you eliminate all the discrimination against blacks in Brazil, inequality in Brazil will go down by 4%, 3%. Mm-hmm. So not all levels, not all types of inequality are equally hateful. I mean, really, inequality against blacks are more important because it's the worst kind of inequality. But in a quantitative terms, Brazil is not very unequal, because we have huge black-white differential. That is not the main reason why we are so unequal. Our inequality is more related to unequal opportunities to education, that it's related to race, but it's also related to parents' poverty and lack of credit for people in
Thank you. I want to ask you to join me in thanking our speaker, Ricardo Paes de Barros.